All right. Well, thank you. Thanks so much. Hi, everybody. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I am in New York, and yeah, I love the topic of fellowship. And I think before I like jump into the topic, it's always important to start. I could just do a really quick qualification. I don't want to tell like all the all the horror of what it was like to live with this disease because. That's probably you all have your own experience with that. And that's, while it's part of my story, thank God it's not where the story ends, right? That is not where my story ends. So for me, I think one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this particular topic is that I have had tremendous amounts of love and relationships and friends and family in my life, all of them. And yet, my self-centeredness, my total focus on myself and this disease caused me to always feel alone and isolated, even when I was surrounded. I often show pictures, and one of the pictures that I show shows me with my sister and my sister-in-laws. And these are women who love me, who have had my back, who have really been on my side all my life, and yet I could never feel that truth coming from them. All I ever felt was, alone, even with them. Always felt this sense of resentments towards any mistake that they ever made, real or imagined. I kind of walked into every room with that, like in my pocket. And that was a really painful way to go through life. Of course, I was, at the height of my disease, I was also over 300 pounds, just morbidly obese. And I was always feeling the sense of aloneness was because of my body. And there is something about being that overweight. There really is, because there's a difficulty that I felt fitting in physically, fitting into places. I felt big and awkward and like I didn't belong. The problem is that I would lose weight and I would still feel that way. So it wasn't my body that necessarily caused that. It didn't contribute, it didn't help, but it wasn't the cause. And what the only thing that relieved me from feeling that sense of separateness and alone, and really what helped, cure my morbid obesity was a relationship with God. That's it. It's a relationship that I was able to cultivate by very specific directions through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, through 12 simple steps. And I followed those steps. I surrendered everything over to the care of my creator as I understood him. Or didn't understand them, but I wanted to. I desperately wanted a relationship with God. And what happened was a miracle. That's the only way I can describe it. And, yes, my body has been relieved of over 160 pounds, but even better than that is I can be with those people. In fact, I can be with all people, and I don't feel that wall around me. Which is just an incredible gift. And so I really want to talk about this creating the fellowship we crave. And I loved, Laurel's prayer, that opening prayer in the beginning, it hit the nail right on the head. Because what it is that we come to crave is fellowship and not food. And what a beautiful thing that is. I think when we live, when we create a fellowship that we really crave, I think we're living in agreement with what God's will is for his children, for us, his people, because he made us social creatures. And so when I live craving fellowship and I'm able to create it, I believe that I am living in agreement with what God would have me live, how God would have me be. So, we start this, right? We start this topic and it's like, it's going to sound really light and fluffy. Like, are we gonna get all touchy-feely and join hands and like do that whole kumbaya thing? And Maybe you're thinking, like, what does Melissa have to tell me about friends and fellowship? And is it really that important? Like, really, is that what's important here? And I think, like, let's start off with what's a definition of fellowship, you know? Because I always like having like a clear foundation, a starting point with a clear definition. And so here's what some basic elements of fellowship are. One, common beliefs. Two, common work. Three, common faith. Four, common need. Five, a common struggle. Six, other areas in common, including a common purpose. Seven, a common conviction. In other words, a common set of principles. Eight, common hope. And nine, a common mission. A lot of things that we have in common when I read that list, right? So, in order to be productive in a fellowship, believers should share in the responsibility of helping others who may lack the essentials of life. That's what part of the definition of fellowship is. And so, like, all right, let's talk about our common beliefs for a moment. Well, the common belief is that we have a physical allergy and a mental twist, and even more than that, we believe that a power greater than ourselves can and has restored us to sanity, right? That's our common belief. And we so, you know, so here in the chapter to wives, page 105, it says this: we seldom had friends at our homes, never knowing how or when the men of the house would appear. We could make few social engagements. We came to live almost alone. And I'll say, you know, when I read that, I'm thinking, I'm the man in this house that it's referring to. Like, I could hardly have people over because I didn't know how I was going to be on any given day. You know, in this disease, we're cut off from others as well as from God. The disease lives and thrives in isolation. We eat alone, I ate alone, binged alone. We purge alone, people purge alone. We're not, you know, by the way, we're not social drinkers and social eaters. That's what makes us different from normal folks. In fact, you know, for me, eating was the most antisocial activity I could do because I would eat and then I couldn't even hear conversations around me. I just checked out. You know, I have failed to show up for happy occasions. And, you know, one of the most crushing things that I shared, you know, a number of times is that I missed a dear friend's funeral because I was so ashamed by my weight gain. Like, that's how self-obsessed I was. And in Bill's story on page 15, it says this: we've commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us, which is a wonderful thing to feel a part of. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. So it says that we make fast friends. And, you know, fast friends are people who newly meet by circumstances, but they find themselves mutually trustworthy. And so they bond together. And I have friends, you know, I have friends outside these rooms, like real lifelong friends. Colleagues and neighbors, and yet those relationships that have been formed with my fellows, with those of you here, you know, they sometimes, those friendships have happened so quickly. Like some of the people that I have become the closest with, those friendships formed like, oh, it's seemingly overnight. And what have they occurred through? Through a difficulty, through the difficulty that we share, you know, and the fellowship grows up among us. You know, it's not forced and it's not fake. And there's this feeling of inclusion. You know, it's organic. It grows up among us. I think about that growing up process. You know, growing up processes take time. And growing up happens in developmental stages. So there's often, milestones that people can mark off in their maturity. And to me, this is sort of how my friendships and fellowships have grown. I think that, the milestones that I've gone through with fellows in here have been the steps. Those have been the milestones that there are certain people that I remember being on a specific step, and I reached out to them and they offered me something real and tangible and helpful. And holy smokes, there I was making a real human connection around this milestone. We become a part of something. It's a human connection that draws us in. I think a lot of us have been rejected and hurt. It's a common feeling that we've had conditional relationships, or ones that we had to promote some image of ourselves. I felt that a lot. Like I always had to promote this piece of me to get other people to like me, to buy the Melissa product, right? And I don't have to do that here. Here we create friendships that cultivate sustained joy, even when things are going hard. In fact, my friendships have grown out of difficulties. And oftentimes, that's what first draws us to make a friend here. It's a shared difficulty. I have a dear sister and a friend here who, I was having a particularly hard situation with my daughter. And there it was like, I feel like God like handpicks a sister to walk the walk with me. And now the beautiful thing is that problem that brought us together no longer exists. Like it has been remedied and we continued together to trudge the road and our friendships, it grew stronger. Our friendship grew stronger as we helped each other practice the principles of this program with those particular problems. Never once, I'm going to tell you the difference between like outside friends and fellowship. Never once was it, I could bring a problem about a particular about my daughter. Never once did this person say, she's a brat and she's this and she's ungrateful and you ought to. None of that. It was always, let's take this to prayer. Let's pray. I will pray for that for you, right? And let's see, what do the principles in our program teach us? What's our part? What's your part? That's what a fellowship is. That's the difference, So how do we make these fast friendships? Well, in Bill's story, page 16, it says this: we meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and in power. So we get together often, right? Why? To help the newcomer. Our friendships, our relationships, where our shared mission is in saving lives. That's the mission that we're in. So I'm not a fan of meetings, to be honest, where newcomers are either not invited to ever attend or who aren't encouraged to share and ask questions. That's why we really try to hold a sacred space for people to ask their questions, because that's part of our mission. At face-to-face meetings, are you rushing? Here's a good question to ask yourself. Are you rushing only to sit next to your friends? Or do you take a seat next to a newcomer? And I know, today we have these virtual Zoom meetings, but we've got a great avenue, a great vehicle for reaching out. We've got a chat box. Somebody new comes on. Are you, am I looking for their number? Am I looking to say, hi, welcome to the meeting, happy you're here. In Zoom meetings, do you send a message to the new person? Do you take down their names? Do you follow up with a phone call? Right? Page 17, and there's a solution. It says this: we are normally people. We are people who normally would not mix. but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendship, a friendliness, and an understanding, which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner, the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's tables. But unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in and itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news the book carries to those who suffer. So we're given a definition here, friendliness and understanding. We understand our common problem. We show one another understanding. The fellowship, it says here, it's too wonderful for words. I love that. It's like that in itself sounds spiritual, that we have a camaraderie, which is defined as a spirit of good friendship and loyalty among its members of a group. So we're loyal, right? We don't abandon each other. You know, I've heard it before. We don't shoot the wounded in this program. If someone is eating, we don't tell them they're not welcomed. What do? We're kind to them, right? We don't abandon people. If someone is struggling, even to be honest or is unwilling to go to any length, well, we might not continue to work the steps with them, but we're kind, right? If somebody is not able to, willing to be honest, I don't tell them, like, go away. I never want to talk to you again. You know, you're a great big dishonest loser. I mean, that's my fear that someone would have said that to me. Instead, what do? We're nice to them. We're kind. We show them that there's a beautiful gift that's available for them here. We demonstrate it. We remember that they are sick and we treat them like an unwell friend. That's how I was treated. You know, we offer consistent friendship and support for one another, and we're loyal to our principles. You know, the paragraph that talks about friendships that come from being rescued together, and those relationships don't endure once the rescuing is done and the celebration is over. But ours continues indefinitely because in order to remain rescued, we help with the rescuing of still others. Our recovery depends on the growth of our spiritual condition, which is only sustainable through harmonious action. Harmonious meaning free from disagreement. So we try not to spend a lot of time in disagreement. We're bound together through self-sacrifice and through working with others. So for me, my fellowship grows as I work with others to help others, right? Not just as I'm working with others, but as I help others that are working with others. We've got this great long kind of like chain, you know? And what does that look like? What is that in definable terms? Well, I do believe that we refer one another to one another. You know, I don't believe that anonymity at the level of press, radio, film, television, and other public media of communication means that I'm anonymous in an anonymous program. I don't want to be anonymous in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. Now, I don't have a right to disclose any personal information about one person to another. But, if I work with someone and they get well, then I quickly call upon them to help when a new person comes my way. And I make that really clear. I send new sponsees many contact names and numbers of others who I know I've helped and who are willing to help as well. if I know someone needs a sponsor and I'm not available, then I try to hook them up. I try my best to think who's available? Who do I know that's got good, strong recovery? Who's got some set of experiences that might benefit this person? Who's in the same time zone, right, as that person? Some of the very basic things. I look to get to know people as people and not just as projects. People are not my projects. They're people, humans. And we encourage one another to create a fellowship among them. I require sponsees to make a minimum of 3 calls a day. You cannot create the fellowship you crave without reaching out to the fellowship. And what I tell people is actual contacts and not just message leaving only, right? Message leaving only doesn't count. Because I'll tell you, when I was looking to get food, I went through every link to get that food. When I wanted a pint of Ben and Jerry's, I didn't just, oh, well, ShopRite's out. Guess that counts as my search. I went everywhere. I would go everywhere, right? So it's the same thing with making these calls, actual contacts. And when making those calls, I say ask specific questions focused specifically on what you're currently studying, so that your fellowship is based on our common mission. It's not a phone call to talk about our dogs or our cats or the weather, right? But it's about our common purpose. So the friendship and fellowship remains loyal to this cause. We refrain from getting worked up in other causes and outside issues to maintain the re integrity. I refrain from politics and social causes and my own very specific religious practices if it might alienate another, right? So in these calls with fellows, try to be as inclusive and focused on the spiritual principles. I make sure that I am not the only recovered voice they hear. And why is that important that I'm not the only person they talk to? Well, first of all, I might think I know everything, but really I don't. And I might say something that is infused with my opinion, right? I'm human and my perspective. And if I am the only voice that a person hears, then they're only getting my perspective on it. And, I also pray that it never happens. But if somebody is relying only on me, and God forbid I lost my recovery, then the only source for connection to this program would be me to them. And that's not enough. The other thing is, we don't want to encourage any one person to rely too heavily on any one person, because that person is never their higher power. Never. We are human. We will let each other down. Our network needs to be wide. Why else is it important? Because if you make no other connections, who are you going to do your 10 steps with? Like, I personally don't want to find myself having to call upon strangers when I've got some heavy duty personal problems. Right? I want someone who knows me, who knows my story, who, when I get a resentment about my boss, will say, lovingly, yeah, this has come up before. Like, what's your part here? Not someone who doesn't know some of the background and who might buy into the story. I want someone who's going to cut right to the meat of it, right to the heart of it. And, I make calls and I take calls, and I might not call someone with a question, or I may. For me, a consistent practice I have and I suggest to others is in the morning when I meditate and I pray, I ask God, show me how I can be useful today, and specifically who I can help. And then I close my eyes and I see who pops into my head. And I often ask to be shown someone, who I haven't seen or heard in a while. I mean, that's what happens to me. Someone comes in my mind who I haven't seen or heard from in a long time. And then when that person pops into my head, I make sure to reach out to them. Like simple text, simple call. It's pretty amazing practice. And it's always made me feel nearer to my creator, always. In We Agnostics, page 45, it says this. Many times we talk to a new man and we watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But then his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. But we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. So, yes, the fellowship gives hope to others. They get hope from learning about the alcoholic problem from those that have this problem. It lets the fellows know that she's not alone. And since we do this by not lecturing, but by telling our experience, by telling our stories and what happened to us, then it's our recovery that gives them hope. But now the tricky part sometimes happens when we talk about God, because the addict might want to skip that God part, right? But we who have recovered know that there is, by the way, there is no spiritual part of the program. The entire program is spiritual. And the fellowship has a very specific job in relationship with God. And I think it's this: the fellowship can help introduce the sponsee to God. It's like the middleman that might set up the meeting to the God of their own conception. The fellowship is supposed to support, it's supposed to help the person by putting their hand in God's hands. And We Agnostics, page 53, says this: arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. The outlines of the promise of the new land had brought luster to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. So the fellowship welcomes us. And what are we being welcomed to? Well, it says here, we're being welcomed to come and meet God. Like, come, meet God, welcome. And I just think that's so beautiful. Page 55, it says, we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. So, God and friendship, they're part of our makeup. Fellowship, community is natural. It's the way God created us as human beings. We're social animals. We're not snakes. We're not spiders. Those are creatures that don't rely on social structures, many of them. We're human. We do require social connections. We're not designed to live in solitude and alienation. Connection for us is essential. And we find God through friendships and fellowships. We do God's work with others. In the chapter Working with Others on page 89, it says this: life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. So we're told here, there's a must, by the way. There's a must here. We must not miss making friends and creating fellowship. It's a must. It's a command. You need to put yourself in a place where you get to witness people recover and to witness them help others. And fellowship is the bright spot. So, if someone is having difficulty in dark days, having fellowship is like the sunshine. I've been given the opportunity for myself to see many, many fellows recover and then go on to help others. I came here, I was so lonely. That was my experience, you know, at the end of my despair with this disease, that I was so humiliated that I could barely make eye contact. I walked into a meeting and I couldn't look up at the friendly faces that were greeting me because I was so beaten down. I would be in a room with a ton of people and feel alone and disconnected. I'd be at family gatherings, and the only thing I could think of was, what are they serving? Right? Either, why are they serving something that I can't eat? Or there's not going to be enough for me. Or else I was revisiting the ways that each person in that room failed me, you know, and I don't experience life like that anymore. I learned how to be a good friend and a family member through the steps. I practiced it in the rooms first. I genuinely today enjoy being with people and getting to know others. And it's not forced and it's not fake and it's not difficult. It's just become second nature for me. In page 90, it says that you should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others and will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. So part of my recovery is to be happy to talk to others. I can't help others if I don't exert some effort in talking to them, right? I gotta make an effort to reach out to other people. And further in the chapter, Working with Others, from page 94, it says, if your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you may have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you've disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all for the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. So, okay, we don't yell at each other. We're glad to talk, and we demonstrate this in our demeanor. Are you glad to talk to others, right? If you're following the directions, then you're supposed to show this. You know, we're sensible and reasonable and understanding. And fellowship is gentle, right? It's kind. Even if the person is uninterested in following the steps, we're told again, make a friend. It's an, you know, to me, I think it's an interesting friendship because we're honest about the hopeless condition of doing it alone. In fact, we drive home the hopelessness. We make kind, clear suggestions. And I think that's what is often confusing between friendships in the outside world and friendship and fellowship in here, right? In the outside world, maybe, you know, if you were a friend like I was a friend, someone would come to me with a problem and I would give them false hope. I would say, oh, it's going to get better. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be just fine. Or else they brought their problems and I would take their side right away. You know, like, oh, that's terrible what that person did. And here it's very different. I don't give people false hope. I'm not, somebody comes to me, you know, the kindest thing I can do is to drive home the hopeless feature of this malady, right? Because I don't want to give them this idea that just coming here is going to make them suddenly better, because that's not the truth. That is not the truth. So we're honest in the work that we do with one another. Why can I tell them that this is hopeless? Because I can offer them the real solution, right? The real solution. Page 95, it says, never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. Show him how they worked with you. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him that if he wants to get well, you will do anything to help. And that's my truth. That's what I tell people. If someone wants to get well, do anything to help you, right? If he's not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act as your banker, right, or a nurse, it says you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. And this he may do after he gets hurt some more. Okay, so even then, I don't speak in a tone of superiority. When reaching out to another, I'm not better than them. My recovery does not put me above anyone, right? I'm merely a sick girl who followed directions that led me to God, and God healed me. So what I offer another sick and healing, sick and suffering fellow is my friendship and a place in the fellowship with me. I offer them the directions that led me to God. And if they're not interested in finding God, I'm still nice, but I can't sponsor them. How do I know if someone isn't interested? Well, it's not if they're struggling with the food. That's a big mistake. It's if, first of all, if they tell me they're not interested, then they're not interested. I get it, right? If they take no action towards following the directions, then I know they're not interested. And even still, guess what? We offer them friendship and fellowship, even when they're not interested. Even when they say, I'm not willing to do that, we still offer them friendship and fellowship. And I think what we're directed to do, is to leave the welcome mat out and the porch light on. That's how I like to think about it. My welcome mat is out, my porch light is on. Because I never know when they're going to really decide that they're ready. It says on page 103, someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem, but we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness or hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. So fellowship is never the byproduct of hostility and bitterness. We don't bully the sick into getting well, right? I am blessed to have been, a teacher. I always share this. I've been a teacher. It's 26 years now. And I've seen bitterness and hostility in teachers. It doesn't work. Bitterness and hostility make people nervous. It makes a student nervous. And fear-filled people don't learn. And it's the same thing in Overeaters Anonymous. If they're afraid, if they're met with bitterness and hostility, they're nervous, right? When people are frightened, the truth is that there's a part of our brain that's responsible for rational thinking. And when you're nervous, it doesn't, it that part of your brain doesn't dominate. It actually goes into like retreat. So, the fellowship is supposed to be a warm and caring place. You can be clear and direct without inciting fear or being cruel. In fact, for me, if I'm going to err on one side or the other, I'm going to err on the side of love. If I'm not sure whether what I'm going to say is mean or honest, I want to go with kind first. I'm never going to be dishonest, right? I'm going to always err on the side of love. I don't believe a sponsee should be afraid to tell their sponsor anything, whether they ate or not, they should not be afraid. Now, the problem is that oftentimes this disease is very cunning and baffling, and it will vilify the help that's available. But I believe that that's something that I'm going to work hard to counteract as a sponsor, that I need to be someone who the person can come to. Honestly, and same thing with the co-fellow in the program. I've never refrained from eating, because fear, right? That never kept me from going back to the food. I refrained, what I did refrain from doing when I was afraid from being honest. I was afraid, I refrained from reaching out. The food pulls on me in such a way. And it was never a match for fear, right? Fear always won out. Fear always won out. And If you want to build a fellowship, one of the things we're warned against is to steer clear of religious arguments. You can have different religious practices and beliefs, but we don't look to convert or persuade. And we're told that in the family afterwards, that we don't argue about religion. Page 133 says this: "We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to a belief that this life is a vale of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. So God wants us to have friends and be happy." And, in the chapter of Vision for You, it talks all about this fellowship. That it says here, there's this thing on page 152. It says, "I know I must get along without liquor. How can I? Have you a sufficient substitute?" Well, yes, there's a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you." I want to make sure I get to the important part. The purpose of the fellowship is so that we can be useful, right? Our spiritual health, well-being is reliant on our usefulness. And who are we supposed to be useful with? Useful for? It's one another. There are many ways that we can help create the fellowship we crave. Obviously, it's through the work of sponsorship is one of the best ways. And it's also through supporting one another. I think a beautiful practice that helps one another form this kind of fellowship is the prayers that we do together. When somebody takes their third step, I think one of the most moving moments for many people, myself included, was doing it with three other recovered people. Oftentimes, that very act of taking their third step with another, preferably, if you could do it via Zoom, even better, or face to face, eye to eye, where you can see each other. But I know that people who have taken their third step with somebody, they feel this power come in, and it helps cultivate, it solidifies a friendship, and that friendship's foundation is in surrendering their will and their lives over to the care of their creator. That's the kind of friendships that fellowship is all about. And I think when we have those kinds of fellowships, we have those kinds of friendships that help us cultivate a relationship with our Creator. We have a formula that sustains us, that carries us, and it gives us, joy, peace, and beautiful recovery. And with that, I will pass.